This week marks 1 year since the first case of COVID-19 was announced in Nevada. For the next hour, you'll hear from Nevadans who've experienced various types of loss and challenges during the pandemic. But even with the hardships of the last year, people in the community showed up for one another. For KUNR News, I'm Ann Gray.
And I'm Lucia Starbuck. It's been a year since the COVID-19 pandemic hit close to home. The first presumptive case was announced in southern Nevada on March 5th of last year.
Now the coronavirus has found its way to Las Vegas.
Today we are announcing the first presumptive case of coronavirus in our community. A
50-year-old Clark County. Then Washoe County confirmed its first presumptive positive case the next day.
With breaking news, there is a new presumptive positive case of COVID-19, also known as coronavirus, this time in Washoe County.
The second case in Nevada.
During this time, the pandemic has affected all of us to some degree. Many of us are still working from home. Others are still going to school on Zoom. And who hasn't missed out on a special celebration or canceled travel plans? But there have been bigger losses, too. Some have lost jobs, gotten sick with COVID, or even lost a loved one to the virus. Lucia, the pandemic has hit seniors particularly hard. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah. So on nearly 68% of all COVID-19 related deaths in Washoe are among those 70 and older. I recently met Darlene Doherty at her Reno home. She lost her 84-year-old husband, Dave Randolph, in December. We mutually agreed to safety precautions before the interview. And once I got there, oh my gosh, Ann, I was so nervous to bump into her fragile antiques. And I quickly learned they each had a special story. She held a miniature teapot set in the palm of her hand, and she shared this story of another heirloom.
This is also something very precious to me. This was my baby silverware. My grandpa Tittle made this for me.
Darlene soon got Dave into antiquing as well. They loved to travel and always made a point to visit an antique shop on their trips.
The large picture at the top of the eagle he bought in Baltimore and came home on an airplane carrying that back in the day when you could do that kind of thing. And ever since then, we expanded and did hawks and owls, and we collected some pictures of kiwis when we were in New Zealand and that kind of thing.
Standing among their shared treasures, Darlene recalls the last time Dave was in their home. He wasn't feeling well, but they didn't know at the time that he had COVID-19.
The last 3 days he was here, he didn't come downstairs at all. He said, I just don't have the strength to come down. So I was taking up protein drinks, and I was making sure he had his meds that he was taking. And occasionally I'd come get some sherbet, and we'd sit on the edge of the bed and eat the sherbet. And then finally on Thanksgiving morning, he got up to go to the bathroom. And I knew he sort of stumbled on the way in, but he said to me, I can't get up to get out. So I had to go. He had had a walker from when he had his hip replaced. And so I went and ran and got the walker, and I was able to get him back over to the bed. I got him to my side because it was closer, and got him so he could sit on the edge of the bed. But we were having trouble trying to get him into bed so he could actually lay down and relax. And working. And after a while, I said, I'm not making this. I need to get help.
Darlene called 911, and Dave was taken to Renown in Reno. He tested positive for COVID-19 and had to be hospitalized because his health was declining. Darlene was really worried because he had pre-existing conditions affecting his heart and kidney.
By then, because he was in the COVID unit, I was not allowed to go in and see him. I called the next 17 days a roller coaster ride. Up and down and up and down as far as how he was doing and not doing. I would call there. I knew nurses' schedules changed at 7 and 7. So I would try to call like 5:36 before they were going off, but not right at 7. And tried to not bother them, but I needed to know, how is he today?
Darlene got spotty updates about how Dave was doing. And then she got the phone call she dreaded. Darlene describes what it was like to hear her husband of 45 years had died.
To get a phone call at 6:15 in the morning on the day after you've talked to what you thought was a recovering husband and told that he passed away during the night, it's like, now what do I do? And that was a Sunday morning. You know, the saddest thing about the whole situation, not only did he leave this house on the 26th of November, and I didn't get to see him, I talked to him occasionally for the next 17 days, but because of COVID, I couldn't see him at the mortuary. So it was sadder to have no way to say goodbye.
Thinking of others who might find themselves in a similar situation, Darlene felt compelled to do something. So she wrote to Dr. Tony Salonim, the head of Renown. She hand-delivered the letter when she went to pick up Dave's belongings from the hospital. She read that letter to me.
Dear Dr. Salonim, as the wife of a COVID patient who recently passed away in your hospital, I want to express my thanks to you and your staff for the care he was given in the last days of his life. These are incredibly hard times for all. I am aware that nurses and staff are working under dangerous situations and risking their lives by caring for multiple COVID patients. I want you to know I have tried to think of ways I could help with calls to families, especially those senior couples for which one has been hospitalized and the other is home quarantined. If you have any volunteer services that you believe I could help with calls, please let me know. I know how crazy times are, and I want to help not complicate the process for the hospital and for families. Sincerely, Darlene Doherty, Mrs. David Randolph.
Darlene was surprised to get a call from Dr. Salonim himself. He thanked her for reaching out and opened up about the loss of his own father to COVID-19. He said that as a result of her letter, Renown would change their visitation policy. Darlene was relieved to know she had made a difference. Now, all patients at Renown, COVID-19 included, are allowed one visitor at a time. But that doesn't lessen the loss she experienced. Darlene is still dealing with this void, and reminders pop up every day.
One of the things that I've missed since his passing, one of the few programs that we would sit down and watch together on TV was Jeopardy. And I'm so used to hearing the answers on the left side. And now if there's an answer comes out, it's because it might be one of the few questions that I could answer.
Lucia, Darlene's story is so moving. And along with Darlene Doherty, many others have lost loved ones to the virus, too. Throughout the pandemic, nearly 5,000 Nevadans have died. Close to 650 people were from Washoe County. There have been about 300,000 cases statewide. Taking care of COVID-19 patients has been particularly tough on frontline medical workers like Dr. Jenny Wilson. Jenny is an ER doctor and the medical director of the ER department at St. Mary's Regional Medical Center in Reno. She's also the medical director at REMSA, the local ambulance provider.
I had my first really, really, really sad case at the end of March last year, and it was devastating. It was a 57-year-old man. He was healthy, and I could see the fear in his eyes, and his oxygen saturation was low, and he felt bad but not terrible, and I was hopeful and he was hopeful, and then he just experienced this demise. And really one tragic detail that has not been a part of my professional life ever is that the people who died, the family members, didn't get to sit by the side of their dying loved ones. And I can't imagine having a loved one die and being told that I couldn't be by their side.
Jenny says the human toll of the pandemic weighs on her and her colleagues.
You can't help but to think about that as you're going through your daily work. And there's nothing you can do about it. other than, you know, wash your hands, wear a mask, socially distance, stay at home. So the inability to control that, it, for me personally, that produced a great deal of pain. And I know that that has had a huge influence on the providers.
But it's more than just losing patients to COVID-19. Jenny says providers have also been treating some who've endured long-lasting symptoms. They're known as long haulers, people with symptoms lasting weeks or months.
The people who didn't die of COVID but just had long hospital courses, or some of them even just had short hospital courses, many of them are still suffering. Many of them, their lives are permanently changed from the experience of having had COVID. There's people in renal failure. There's people who still, months afterwards, they are so winded when they walk even just short distances. The amount of time it is taking for some people's lungs to recover, it's something that I don't think that the public is really aware of or takes into account, but the numbers of people dead, that's not the only important effect of COVID. It has devastated, I'm sure, at least twice that amount of people who are not dead. And that's something that we see now in the emergency room. These people are still coming back.
One thing that Dr. Jenny Wilson has learned from the pandemic is how incredibly resilient people are despite how bad things can get. Scientists are still working on learning more about the range of short and long-term effects of the novel coronavirus. An early study in the UK found that about 10% of patients have various symptoms that persisted for more than a few weeks.
Thousands of people who survived the virus just can't seem to shake the symptoms, even months after their diagnoses.
Heavy pressure in my chest.
Loss of balance.
Bruising on my arms.
Heart palpitation.
Headache, fatigue.
Jaw pain.
I spoke to one long hauler, Jennifer Cantley from Douglas County, who had COVID-19 in early November. She's still experiencing symptoms like persistent headaches and blurry vision. Her sense of smell hasn't returned either. She has a pre-existing condition that has made it harder to recover. Last year, Jennifer was diagnosed with what's called a pseudotumor. This causes extra fluid, which puts pressure on her brain. Throughout all of this, she's juggling life as a mom of three boys and work. She's an activist for an environmental organization. In this audio diary, Jennifer describes her symptoms, which made returning to work more difficult.
Of course, COVID hit me right on the day of the election. That's when my fiance got diagnosed. It just was like all these emotions at one time, because it's like the fear of the words you don't want to hear as a mom with who has asthma, and then two children who have asthma. And then bam, oh, now you got COVID. You know, like November 5th was when I just started, all of a sudden my body started feeling achy. It felt like a cold was coming on. But it took me about 6 weeks to recover. And I think it might have been because I never really got to rest. It was probably about 4 weeks after I was diagnosed when I first started, the headaches were just like really pounding. It was headaches and not being able to sleep at all, and took me just where I could barely see straight, and just I couldn't even open my eyes. I was actually on a call with Senator Cortez Masto's office for work, and I'm looking at the screen and I noticed my left eye is like extremely dilated. So I ended up taking a screenshot of myself and I sent it to my neurologist, and she's like, that's not good. So they sent me to an MRI again. They did find some extra white spots that weren't there in September for my last MRI. The interesting thing is my ear ringing was a new thing. It turned from the high pitch, like fire alarm ringing, to this low bass, like a foghorn going off. And it would go like really low. They now have me on 6 different medications to tame this, all these different headaches. Yes, I may get my smell back. Yes, these symptoms may go away, and I pray to God they do, and I don't have to be on medication. But right now I'm classified as a long hauler.
Jennifer Cantley's experience with COVID-19 has caused her to miss work, like many other Americans during the pandemic. Nevada faced record unemployment. Many businesses had to shut down temporarily, and some never recovered.
The COVID economic shutdown hit Las Vegas harder than any other major city in the nation.
So when the Strip shuts down, much of the economy surrounding it shuts down.
Yeah, that's right. And
the ripple effect. On how has the pandemic affected the state's economy?
Since Nevada's economy is so tied to gaming and tourism, it's been hard for the state to bounce back. In 2020, the gaming industry took a hit and was down $6 billion in revenue from the previous year. In mid-March, Governor Steve Sisolak closed non-essential businesses. Nevada's unemployment rate skyrocketed to 28.2% in April. That's the highest unemployment rate ever reported for a state in the U.S. That same month, 300,000 Nevadans applied for unemployment benefits. Current data ranks the state 50th in the nation for its highest unemployment rate, with about 9% of Nevadans out of work. Lucia, what's it like in California?
Well, on across the border, California is not faring much better. The state ranks 49th in unemployment. I talked to Michelle Murphy, who worked as a bartender in downtown Truckee. She's been out of work since mid-March. I talked to her about how she weathered those hard times, which really ramped up with the cancellation of major sporting events last March.
I was working the night that the NBA decided to shut down all their games, and there was a lot of concern about what was actually happening with this pandemic, yeah. And a lot of fear, I guess, involved with being so exposed. So initially, I don't think we anticipated it being such a severe closure.
What point did you go back to work?
We did reopen in the summer. I want to say maybe was it around the end of May or June? And we returned to work at minimum capacity, 25% capacity. I ended up contracting COVID through work.
Oh my gosh.
And I say that it was through work because we didn't have fiberglass partitions in place. At that point, masks weren't mandated. A lot of customers were coming in and refusing to wear masks.
Did you experience symptoms? Are you doing okay?
I was really sick for about 2 weeks and then overall pretty impaired for about 6 weeks to 2 months. And then during that time, my job filled my position and didn't keep it open for me.
Where are you applying? Where would you like to work next?
Well, honestly, with contracting COVID, I'd actually really like a job with benefits now because I'd like to go see a doctor. I've actually decided to try to go back to grad school. If I do begin grad school, that won't be until the fall, and I would still need to be working even while I was attending school. I am looking for jobs. I literally all day have been on the computer updating my LinkedIn and working with Indeed and keeping that resume fresh and networking as much as I can, but the job market has really shrunk, especially with everything being smaller capacity. A lot of places aren't hiring anymore.
How has losing your job impacted you financially?
Holy cow. It's been substantial. I'm pretty frugal with my money and I've been working really hard my whole life. So luckily I made sure I had savings just in case there was an emergency. And unbeknownst to me, 3 months later, look at what happened.
What have you learned over this past year that you think you'll take with you?
Probably that working so much and being apart from your family really doesn't make much sense. And prioritizing your time and being able to be with family and friends has been something that I'd really like to work harder on.
Even though losing her bartending job during the pandemic was a curveball, Michelle Murphy is looking to work in a different industry and going back to school. After this short break, we'll explore how the economic instability during the pandemic has affected vulnerable communities and exacerbated food and housing insecurities. Welcome back. For KUNR News, I'm Lucia Starbuck.
And I'm Ann Gray. If you're just joining us, we're examining how the pandemic has been affecting Nevadans. The economic fallout created hardships for many individuals and families. In the last 3 months of 2020, the Food Bank of Northern Nevada served an average of 115,000 people each month. The Mobile Harvest is the food bank's program that enables people to drive through and pick up a few grocery bags of fresh food. Lucia and I met up one winter morning at a drive-thru food bank in Sparks.
Okay, you're all set.
When I drove up to the parking lot of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, there were already dozens of cars in line, which wrapped around the parking lot. There was also an assembly line of volunteers packing fresh foods.
Mimi Crone is one of the volunteers putting cabbage, bananas, and celery into a bag. She's been with the food bank for about 5 years and has gotten to know the people she serves.
I hear about their families. I hear about their needs. Many of them are veterans. Many of them are elderly. Some of them are unemployed. Some of them are homeless. It's a whole mixed bag. They all have great personalities, and I care about them. That's why I'm out here doing it.
Mimi has seen an increase in demand over the last year.
You know, up until 5 years ago, I didn't even use the word food insecurities. I would just use hunger, but it really is an insecurity, and it's a very serious thing.
Over the course of about 3 hours, between 300 to 400 people picked up food. Evella Presser pulled up with her daughter. They live in Sparks, and Evella is a diabetic, so her medical expenses leave her on a tight budget.
So I came to see if they could help me. And for me, it makes a lot of difference because I have to go to a lot of doctors and I take medicine, and I just can't afford to do that if I have to buy groceries. So I don't have to buy as many groceries, so I can actually get better medical care. And I was just thrilled to death to have the opportunity to take care of other aspects of my life because I wasn't so worried about not having food to eat.
And like Evella, people in similar situations must choose between food and medicine. But it can still be difficult to ask for help.
And honestly, I felt a little guilty. I'm not on the street. I have a home. I'm very grateful to have a car. Do I really need this? But it's really helped me. I've been able to go to the doctor 3 different times when I wasn't able to go before. I just was able to use the money that I would normally have to use towards the groceries and still maybe not have enough to take better care of myself.
There are a lot of factors that contribute to rising food insecurity, such as high medical costs, expensive housing, and low wages.
Someone who knows more about this is Jocelyn Lantrip. She's worked with the Food Bank of Northern Nevada for more than a decade. She's seen the region weather many economic downturns, including the Great Recession.
This has been food insecurity like we have never seen before. I did work at the food bank during the recession, and we did see some high numbers. It wasn't as immediate, it wasn't as widespread, it wasn't as long lasting. A lot of people that are low income haven't really recovered from the recession, and then this hit.
Since some people have not recovered from the Great Recession, the economic crisis during the pandemic made it even harder to recover financially. After non-essential businesses were ordered to close in mid-March of last year, Jocelyn saw widespread unemployment create a higher demand. In April, one drive-through event at the Grand Sierra Resort in Reno served about 1,000 families in 3 hours.
Who we're seeing now are more unemployed people, people that have been affected very directly by the pandemic, if they have had somebody in their family or they themselves have been sick and haven't been able to work. People who work in the hospitality industry, they're back to work, but it's so limited, the amount of money that they can make. And rents haven't gone down. So we're still seeing that high rent, high expense issue that we had before the pandemic. And now we've added a lot of unemployment, a lot of underemployment. And so we're seeing a lot of new people.
The rate for childhood food insecurity in Nevada is tied with Louisiana for the worst in the nation, and more than 1 in 10 seniors statewide don't have enough to eat. The food bank is also focused on reaching people in rural communities.
Certain areas have been harder hit. We have definitely seen significant need in the tribal communities and have stepped up that effort significantly as well.
Jocelyn says the food bank relied on donations from businesses and individuals. Others have stepped up to help the food bank too, including the Nevada National Guard. Members have also assisted with contact tracing and worked at testing and vaccination sites.
C. Senior Airman Dakota Rainwaters was busy directing cars through the food pickup line the day we were there. He's been with the Guard for 4 years and was born and raised in Reno. In this audio diary, he explains what it's like to be activated during the pandemic in his home state.
We started officially in April, and we've been working hard ever since. Some of us came off orders about August of 2020, but some of us decided to come back in December because we saw that this pandemic wasn't going away, but the community needed us. So since April, I've been working at the testing center and checking people in for testing. Worked in the epidemiology center, just calling people and letting them know their situation, just contact tracing. And then now that I'm back, just been working vaccines. What I've learned in the pandemic is, you know, make sure that you always have your friends back. Be safe, you know, make sure that you're taking care of yourself, your family, and just be nice to people because, you know, you don't know what people are going through, especially during this pandemic, because it's affected people in different ways. My military family definitely got me through this. My actual family as well got me through this. You know, it was hard in the beginning, you know, just the quarantine and, you know, the work issue, because this, I was working a civilian job before I got activated for this. And so it was hard trying to find a job for a while, but luckily, you know, the military came in and said, hey, we got these orders. You want to come out and help us out? I'm like, absolutely, I'm in. And so I made a lot of great friends, a lot of great family. And so, you know, I'm going to take these guys with me to the grave.
Senior Airman Dakota Rainwater says his plan is to serve a full 20 years, and his goal is to retire as a Chief Master Sergeant. About 1,400 Nevada National Guard members have served throughout the pandemic so far. This is the largest and longest activation in their history.
The pandemic's economic effect on Nevada is ongoing, which has further exposed food and housing disparities. Nearly 38% of adults in Nevada haven't been able to catch up on their rent or mortgage and are at risk of facing an eviction or foreclosure within the next 2 months, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. To understand this situation more, I spoke to Lacey Foster, the manager of the Desert Rose Inn, a motel in downtown Reno. Lacey has lived and worked there for about 8 years. There are nearly 100 rooms at the motel, and most people living there are long-term tenants, including families with children. Lacey says many of her tenants worked in the casino industry and lost their jobs early on.
I'd say maybe half got their jobs back. A lot of them lost their jobs when this all first started. You know, they were the ones that were really stressed out about, you know, not paying rent, and they were making payments. I mean, any sort of a payment, you know, that they could. Most of them that did start receiving unemployment did start paying. So, and you know, of course, you know, we're working with people, but there's a large majority that just stopped paying. So it's been difficult.
Lacey says money is tight for her tenants, and some have been bringing in $20 here and there, or what they could afford for rent. Governor Steve Sisolak put an eviction moratorium in place a year ago to help keep people housed. With fewer people paying rent, Lacey says it's harder to keep the motel running.
I mean, we have water, sewer, power, the business license. We've got payroll, of course.
The moratorium has been extended several times, and it's set to expire at the end of this month. As more and more motels are demolished to make way for new developments in Reno, Lacey worries that people who need low-cost housing will have even fewer places to go.
This is like the step before people are homeless. Even though it is a motel, it's still a room. And there's water, there's everything that a person needs. A home is a home. You know, wherever you make it, that's what it is. And everybody should have a roof over their head. But, you know, we have a lot of older tenants here, you know, veterans. We need motels. We need them. We really do need them. Across from us is a big empty lot where there used to be another motel. It is now filled with all the signs of all the motels that have been torn down. That's what we look at all day, is the graveyard, the motel graveyard. The way that I feel is like, what's next?
The eviction moratorium is set to be lifted in a few weeks, and if that happens, thousands of Nevadans may lose their homes.
The pandemic has had so many ripple effects, including economic uncertainty, and also increasing anxiety and loneliness for some. One group particularly at risk for isolation are seniors who live in congregate settings like skilled nursing facilities and assisted living. Many facilities experienced outbreaks that led to infections and deaths.
To reduce the risk of infections, facilities closed to visitors. This must have been so tough for residents and their family members. On, you recently visited the Seasons of Reno, an assisted living and memory care home. What's their visitation policy like now?
Well, the visitation policies at the facilities are following guidelines set by health officials to limit exposure to the virus. When I first arrived at the Seasons of Reno, I went through a screening process.
For the temperature.
Oh, for the temperature.
Then, Lucia, this part really surprised me. A staff member disinfected my shoes.
Just a disinfectant, the other one?
Oh, nice.
Awesome. Next, I was taken over to the visitation area. That's where families can see each other while seated 6 feet apart with a full-length plexiglass partition between them. Once there, I got a squirt of hand sanitizer while a staff member wiped down my seat.
And then I am going to have to wipe down the chairs before you sit down. When people come to visit, we just like to make sure that the room is sanitized to keep everybody safe. As you can see, there's the
plexiglass. She then went to the other side and sanitized the area for Donald Michelle. Donald is a 79-year-old retired aeronautical engineer who has been living at the Seasons of Reno for about 2 years. He moved there with his wife because she needed care. Sadly, he lost his wife of 59 years this past October. It was not COVID-related. Even though they moved to the facility for her care, he's staying put for now because of the pandemic. Donald says it's been a trying year, and he misses many activities he once enjoyed with his family before the pandemic. He has two sons who live in Reno and a daughter in California.
You know, I miss the ability to go out in the town and do shopping and go places with my boys and stuff. And there are not many residents still drive, but I still have my car so I can come and go as I please then. My wife enjoyed Reno. We would go to some of the plays downtown and shows and things like that. And we had to stop that. That was a big deal for me, but I understand the pandemic. The freedoms that I've had to give up, I think, are worth it. I'm still alive and just as healthy as I was before we started, and I consider myself something of a pandemic veteran now.
When I was chatting with Donald, we were both masked up, so I couldn't see his whole face, but I could see his eyes light up when he talked about his family.
I see my boys regularly, and my daughter lives in Lancaster, California. She came up, so I've been able to visit with her. And then her daughter brought my great-grandchildren up here so I could see them. The only drawback is they bring these cute little babies up here and you can't grab them and hold them like you'd like to. But at least you get to see them and hear their first words and things like that.
Since Donald lives in a residential community due to safety precautions, he's not quite able to go into town quite yet. I asked him what's the first thing he'd like to do when he can go out again.
The first thing I'd like to do? I would like to go down. Here's a little ad for a restaurant. I'd like to go down to the Gold and Silver for breakfast with my youngest son. I always have a couple eggs over easy, bacon, and hash browns, and then I have a couple of pancakes too. It's a lot, but it's all really good.
Wow, An, thank you so much for sharing Donald Michelle's story. He's so endearing. I hope he gets to eat a big breakfast with his family soon. It's evident the pandemic took a heavy toll on many long-term care facilities, which experienced outbreaks nationwide. In Washoe, about 1 out of 5 COVID-19 deaths were linked to residential facilities like assisted living and nursing homes. In Nevada, a variety of these state-licensed facilities, which also include behavioral inpatient and correctional facilities, experienced more than 14,000 cases statewide. More than 800 residents and more than 20 staff members have died. They account for 17% of all COVID-19 deaths in the state. One person who is aware of how COVID-19 has affected these shared living facilities is Dr. Laura Knight. She's the chief medical examiner and coroner for Washoe County. She talked with me about how the pandemic has really reduced the lifespan of a lot of older Americans.
Unfortunately, COVID has hastened the end of life for many of those individuals who probably had quite a bit more time to live, even with their underlying conditions.
Dr. Knight, we saw during the pandemic, some people were hesitant to go to the hospital. And because of that, did you see deaths that could have been prevented?
One way that we can measure that is to look at the number of scene responses in 2020. They made 1,094 scene responses versus 948 in 2019. So that's a 15% increase. I think a lot of people postponed medical care that they probably really needed. And certainly we had individuals tell us that their loved one said, I'm having chest pain, but I'm not going to the hospital because I'm afraid I'll get COVID. We have heard that history multiple times in doing our investigations of death. We had a lot of people that died at home, either from COVID or from other natural diseases like heart attacks, because they were afraid to go to the hospital.
Did funeral homes and mortuaries hit capacity or near capacity?
They did. They were over capacity. Some of them were over capacity here in Reno and in Carson City. Occasionally, during really busy times of the year, particularly January tends to be anyway a very busy time of the year for mortuaries, but nothing to the scale of what we saw with COVID, where, you know, basically every mortuary almost was full. It was really a very unique time, and I hope we don't see it again, to be honest.
Coming up after the break, we'll look at how the pandemic forced people to change the way they live and work. If you're just joining us, welcome to KUNR's special coverage on how the pandemic has affected Nevadans. For KUNR News, I'm Lucia Starbuck.
And I'm Ann Gray. Early in the pandemic, some healthcare facilities struggled with PPE shortages. So far, Nevada has administered nearly 3 million total tests. As COVID-19 infections became more widespread, Governor Steve Sisolak said ramping up testing was critical.
We know that increasing our COVID-19 testing volume is one of our immediate and long-term goals, and doing so is challenging.
In northern Nevada, tests were analyzed at the Nevada State Public Health Laboratory, located at the University of Nevada, Reno School of Medicine. Throughout the pandemic, the nation's public health system has been stretched to its limit. And that's true in Nevada as well. I spoke with Dr. Mark Pandori, who runs the lab. He explains what he was up against.
The biggest challenge is, and there's two of them. Firstly, was back in March and April, and it was the supply chain. And we narrowly here in Nevada dodged that. I mean, we were hit by it. We had severe supply chain issues, but there was never a single day that we couldn't test. But we came awfully, awfully close to it.
At times, especially early on during the pandemic, some testing materials simply weren't available.
The system is incredibly fragile. Like, even to this day, we are still worried. We still are okay, but all of the public health labs and the clinical labs that do SARS-CoV-2 testing, as of this moment that you and I are talking, are worried about plasticware. A few months ago, we were worried about where to get certain chemicals to do extractions. And, you know, not just lab people learned that, but anybody that needed PPE, you know, to be on the front lines in the hospitals knew how fragile those supply chains were for everything.
On top of limited supplies, the labs were also slammed.
When we had surges in the summer and then in the fall, no amount of testing that labs could possibly fit inside their building would be enough to meet the demand. There's not enough physical laboratory space on Earth to meet the challenges that occur when there's a surge and everyone needs testing. It's like if you had an amusement park and everybody wants to ride the roller coaster, the only thing you can do is build more roller coasters, but you can't do that in real time.
Despite the many challenges for the lab over the last year, there have also been moments that affirmed Mark's faith in the community.
You know, one of the major shortages back in March and April and May were the collection vials needed. Something, you know, that sounds pretty simple. You know, you need a collection vial, which is a swab and some chemical. You couldn't get those anywhere. You know, those were sold out. Here, the microbiology department at UNR School of Medicine put together a system to build them. Everybody was coming in on the weekends to make sure that those were built and sterilized and quality controlled. And certain businesses in the community stepped up to say, hey, we can build those too. And when the swabs were a shortage, you know, people on campus here figured out how to 3D print those swabs. These were people external to the public health lab. I mean, they could have stayed home and watched Netflix when we were all instructed to do so, but everyone on this medical campus stepped up, and that will never be forgotten.
As Dr. Mark Pandori pointed out, the pandemic highlighted how crucial public health services are to a community in general, and especially in a crisis. Nevada was already ranked among the lowest in the nation for public health investment before the pandemic. Not much has changed. The state spends about $11 per person for public health services, which ranks second to last in the nation. For comparison, Washington, D.C. spends $363 per person.
And as we've learned, with a lack of funding for public health, there are going to be gaps. Some groups aren't getting the information they need. For example, there's a lack of resources about COVID-19 testing and vaccinations in languages other than English. At the same time, COVID-19 has been disproportionately affecting Latino communities nationwide and in Nevada. Hispanic or Latino individuals make up slightly more than a third of all COVID-19 cases in the state, but they only make up 29% of the population. I talked to one of KUNR's bilingual reporters, Natalie Van Hooser, who's been reporting on the various factors that lead to these disparities.
To look at one aspect of this, many Latinos are frontline workers. I talked to Maria Davis about this, and she's a professional interpreter who's worked in Latino community outreach throughout the pandemic.
A lot of our Hispanic families are working families. Not everybody can afford to stay home, so they have to go out there and find a way to still bring some food to the table.
Natalie says another issue is institutional mistrust. People who are undocumented can be hesitant to access services, like getting a COVID-19 test or vaccination, because they're worried they'll have to reveal their immigration status. Despite that common fear, your immigration status isn't required for COVID-19 testing and vaccination.
These types of things are not new, but the pandemic has exacerbated the need for resources.
That's why Natalie has been hosting virtual events in Spanish, so those community members can speak directly with their local leaders. One focused on schools reopening to shed light on how challenging the adjustment to remote work has been for many students and families dealing with language barriers on top of everything else.
One of the most noticeable obstacles for some Spanish-speaking families was that some parents can only help their children in Spanish while their classes are in English. In some cases, parents who only speak Spanish worked with classroom assistants who usually help Spanish-speaking students to learn English. These assistants served as interpreters on the phone and helped answer questions about online learning. Many parents asked if it was safe to send their kids back to school. That was a concern for families across the board. Nurse practitioner Sonia Rich-Maceo was a guest during our event.
Es un riesgo ir a la escuela hoy en día. Es increíble, pero así es.
Here she's saying that there is a risk with sending your kids to school in person, but that's a personal decision that each family has to make.
That was a difficult conversation I'm sure many families had to have over the past year. Last March, Governor Steve Sisolak ordered schools to close their doors statewide. Reopening schools was polarizing and plagued with many challenges across the state. Many working families struggled with childcare, and many teachers had concerns about their safety. I was at a protest in front of the Washoe County School District's admin building in early August, where teachers and parents demonstrated. They wanted to postpone returning to in-person learning. The Washoe County School District decided to not delay the reopening of classrooms in the fall with a mix of hybrid, full distance, and in-person learning. Schools also provide more than just a learning environment. They're a place to get meals and other support services.
Next, we hear from Janelle Olisea, a senior at the Academy of Arts, Careers, and Technology in Reno. She chatted with her English teacher, Greg Burge, to reflect on the challenges and triumphs of the last year, including getting into her dream college.
What was going through your head when you were trying to figure out how to, like, teach? I can't imagine what was happening. Just tell me about, like, just trying to figure out how this was going to work.
My main concern at that point in time was just, are kids okay? Because there were some kids that weren't. We wanted to make sure that kids were okay because we were starting to get lots of kids in crisis and realizing how much some students rely on school as a place to not just learn, but to eat, to get some kind of social help, to get some sort of outside of their family guidance that they weren't getting. I was more just concerned about my fellow human beings, and I was kind of glad to have a job where I could at least feel like I was trying to reach out and help some people in crisis.
Yeah, I mean, when you're put into this unprecedented situation, sometimes grades and everything else that comes with school isn't your main concern. Sometimes yeah. It's just, you know, surviving, trying to figure out what your next step is. It's a year into this pandemic. I lost part of my junior year, and my senior year is basically non-existent. And my experience as a hybrid student has just been, it's just such a drastic shift in my education. You know, I'm so used to coming to school every day, forming relationships with my peers and my teachers. It's weird. It's definitely something that, like, you don't really prepare for in any way. You just kind of have to go with it.
I got to say, working with you, kiddo, this year has been one of the most rewarding things that I've done. We would meet and talk about your, not essays for my class, but your essays that we're using to get into colleges and get scholarships and all those kinds of things. And it gave me a lot of hope to see that people still cared about learning. In the midst of all this craziness that we're going through, it gave me a little sense of, like, okay, I can still teach. I can work with a kid. That's what I want to do. And so I'm really grateful to you for coming to me and letting me do a little bit of that too and make it feel like, oh yeah, I'm still a teacher. That felt good.
I never wanted to bother you so much when I was doing my college and scholarship essays because I know, you know, teachers are just going through it this year. It's just so difficult just adapting to everything. But you would always remind me, like, this is why I do what I do.
One thing that I think you guys are going to have is the ability to deal with crisis, which I got to say is probably the number one skill that you need to survive college or anything after high school, right? You guys might be missing out on a few things or a few books, but those books will be there. You can go read those books. You can go learn that skill. That's what college is for. You go continue your education. But the thing that you guys are learning, the survival skills and the ability to withstand disappointments and to make amazing progress in that disappointment. Like, I think when we look historically, we look at our nation, we look at, or the world in general, people who survive are strong. And so I have a lot of faith that you guys are going to be awesome in college.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I mean, I reached out to you like first week of school. As soon as we got to hybrid learning, I was like, Mr. Burge, hi, you don't know me, but I really want to apply to college. I want scholarships. I just became super motivated when I was stuck at home. I was like, there's nothing else I can do. I was like, I mean, I might as well make the most out of this situation. I started applying for college in July. At the same time, it was super overwhelming for me. And, you know, I was just trying to figure out everything with my future, with everything going on. It's weird to think about the future when you don't even know what's going to happen tomorrow. I got a full ride to Stanford. So
most of the work that we did was over Zoom or over just over the computer. And so you don't have to apologize for taking up my time, but just being able to work with kids with their writing and with their goals is what I love to do. It gave me hope that there's something beyond this for you guys, but for me too.
It's been a journey for both of us, you know.
Janelle Olesea is an alum of KUNR's youth media program. It's nice to hear how she's doing and learn how her English teacher, Greg Burge, made such a difference in her life. Stanford is lucky to have her. But as her teacher pointed out, many students are struggling. Recent data from Washoe County School District shows nearly 40% of high school students are failing at least one subject, and almost a quarter are failing in two. Also, the number of students missing 18 days or more of school, known as chronic absenteeism, has tripled across the district from the previous year. Pacific Islander, Black, Hispanic, and American Indian students are missing more school compared to white and Asian students.
And down in the Clark County School District, students didn't return to in-person learning for almost a year. They are just beginning to transition back to some in-person learning this month through a hybrid model. Health officials say one step to get more students and teachers back into the classroom safely is vaccinating more educators. The state has set up guidelines for how to get the population vaccinated, starting with frontline medical workers, seniors 70 years and older, and other essential workers like educators.
It's important that we provide a balance between essential workers that we need to continue to deliver services.
That was Kevin Dick, the head of the Washoe County Health District. Nevada's mass vaccination effort has faced many hurdles. Some issues included delayed shipments from the federal government and not enough people to help. Now the state has the Nevada National Guard, FEMA, and volunteers placed at different vaccination sites across the state. As soon as vaccinations became available, the Washoe County Health District saw a high demand in the community. Tens of thousands of seniors are on the health district's wait list. To help with vaccinating seniors, the Sparks Fire Department is pitching in. We went to their first vaccine clinic for seniors 70 and older in late February.
On a bluebird morning, a few seniors were in front of a rec center in Sparks. They only had to wait a few minutes before making it inside. Many people have been waiting and hoping for a vaccine since the pandemic began. Captain Tyler Gayton organized this appointment-only clinic and has worked with the Sparks Fire Department for 16 years. Tyler said he and a few colleagues got the virus as frontline workers, so it's especially rewarding for him to now take part in the vaccination effort. This was the first of many clinics that his department plans to offer. As we made our way inside, Tyler said signups opened online a week before the clinic, and the 100 spots available filled up in minutes. Once people confirmed their appointment, they headed over to a table with small vials of vaccines. Before they knew it, it was over. After the shot, people were asked to wait at least 15 minutes so the paramedics and EMTs could monitor people for adverse reactions. Federal health officials have reported side effects, including fatigue, sore arm, and slight fever. To get their symptoms monitored, the seniors rested in another part of the gym, with chairs spaced apart. That's where 70-year-old Steve Spear was waiting. He was happy to report. For Steve, he felt fine and quite relieved to get his first dose. He reflected on how hard this past year has been. So far, slightly more than 14% of Nevadans have received their first shot, and nearly 8% have gotten both doses. Seniors 65 and up have also become eligible.
We really enjoyed meeting Steve Speer and all the other people we spoke to for the special. We're so grateful they agreed to share their stories and gave us a glimpse of what the last year has looked like for them. Some of them have really been through a lot.
I'm with you, Lucia. It seems everyone has a unique yet universal pandemic experience. I don't think we'll forget them, their stories, their voices. We've learned that it's been a long year, a year of pain and loss for many, but also of perseverance and of people stepping up to help one another. Home means Nevada, home means the
hills, home means the sage and the pine. We would like to give thanks to our KUNR colleagues, to our editors Michelle Billman and Crystal Willis, who helped shape this project. Thank you. And a shout out to Jaden Perez, Olivia Ollie, and Natalie Van Hooser for their contributions, along with Noah Glick for technical support. The music you heard throughout this special can be found at freemusicarchive.org.
And the Home Means Nevada track is a collaboration with several musicians from around the state. The primary artists are Eric Henry Anderson, Kaylee Foster, Gina Rose, and Nick Aliberti. Support for the reporting comes from Report for America, an initiative of the Ground Truth Project, and RTDNF, the Radio Television Digital News Foundation. Thank you for joining us. For KUNR News, I'm Awn Gray.
And I'm Lucia Starbuck. With the spotted fawn and doe, all the live long night until morning light is the loveliest place I know.